And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
There goes, it is high, it is far, it is gone! Giambino!
A thriller by Godzilla.
It's an A-bomb from A-Rod.
Burn, baby burn.
El Capitan. Robbie Cano, I don't you know.
Georgie Juice One.
Didi Gregorio. It's Yankee fans. Euphoria.
Oh, the milkman delivers.
That's baseball season.
Mark sends a text message. One of the best games you'll ever see.
Perfect game. Baseball immortality.
The Bambino.
God, number 62 to set the new American League record.
All right. Here comes the judge.
World Series over. Yankees win. The Yankees win.
Hello, that opening clip in remembrance of John Sterling, iconic radio voice of the New York Yankees for 36 seasons, who passed away May 4th, 2026, at the age of 87. He was known for his theatrical and unapologetic style. He became a legendary figure in baseball broadcasting through his vivid catchphrases, personalized home run calls. We'll get into that in a sec. So from the heart of Queens to the ears of sports fans everywhere, this is the Sports Kings from Queens. Strap in. Kings are in session. Today is Tuesday, May 5th, episode 230. I'm Gino, joined by Kevin, joined by Darren. Catch us wherever you get your podcasts. Like, subscribe, follow us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Give us a like, join our pages. Tonight, we'll take you around the world of sports, where we are. I mentioned it in the open, John Sterling. He called a total of 5,631 Yankee games, including 5,060 consecutive games between 1989 and 2019. Before the Yanks, he called games for the Atlanta Braves and the Hawks. Legendary announcer, Darren.
And the New York Cosmos. He was the guy that was there with the Cosmos. He was that announcer. Anyway, Sterling was nowhere near like the textbook top play-by-play guy you'll ever hear. He was not.
Not even close.
But what he was he brought excitement. He brought joy. He brought passion. And he brought originality. And it made him a great listen. For those that weren't Yankee fans, you may not have enjoyed it. I know Kev probably didn't appreciate it as much as Gino or I did. But also remember, though, this is a guy that called 5 World Series championships, 7 pennant championships. He missed 2 games early in his career because his sister died. Then he went 30 straight years without missing a game. And, you know, it's just one of those things, Jay.
Because he did radio and not TV, he called every one of those playoff games. And sometimes the playoff games go to TBS, they go to NBC, they go to wherever, ESPN, wherever the hell the games go. But because he did radio, he did every one of them. And that's something.
And the one thing I'll say that's kind of funny is one of the more historic calls was done by Charlie Steiner and not him when Boone hit the homer in Game 7 against the Red Sox in 03. That was Charlie Steiner on the mic, not Sterling. And Sterling basically made it where he was the play-by-play guy for every inning after that. He didn't want to miss another one of those moments. But, I mean, talk about an Iron Man, 5,060 straight games, 30 years. And the thing about it was the catchphrases. It was the excitement of the call. I mean, listen, you know, to me, Bob Murphy's the best that ever did it on radio. I'm sure there were people before that would say Scully or say Red Barber or say, Mel Allen, a ton of different guys. For my lifetime, Bob Murphy was the best, and I'm not a Met fan. I just thought Bob described the game really, really well. What John did was he brought excitement, and he brought this verve of loving the Yankees and making the Yankees great and exciting in everybody's mind that was listening. If you were not a homer, he was not your guy. But John was, I don't know, man. He was part of our youth. He was part of us growing up in baseball. Jake?
He was a showman is what he was, by the way. Exactly. That's exactly what he was. He was a showman. I'm not a big radio guy. I'm usually a TV guy for games, unless I'm in the car or something. So, for me, especially during those Yankee championship years, if there was a big call or Mike and the Mad Dog played a big call. I had to go listen to it the next day because you knew something was going on with him. Of course, the Yankees win. The Yankees win. That's the big one. Do you have any favorite call, Darren? Any favorite player call?
You know what?
There's so many, obviously, but
Jeter's 3,000th hit was always one that stands out. Mr. November stands out to me. You know, there's so many. Even you know, 96 winning the World Series for the first time, where Wetland gets the save, and the Yankees win the World Series over. You know what I mean? Like where he would kind of be very, very demonstrative. Again, as Kev will tell us in a second, because we're going to make him talk about it for a quick second, this was not your textbook broadcast guy. He was just an iconic part of a great time of Yankee baseball lore. G?
Any personal home run call you like more than others?
Like my favorite one?
Yeah.
You know, when they first got Giambi, the Giambino was kind of fun for me. You're on the Mark Teixeira and A-bomb from A-Rod. Jeterian, Stantonian. There's a million of them to kind of go with.
Robbie Cano, don't you know?
There's a million of these things. Kevin shaking his head. Kev, tell us what you hated about Sterling so much, or was it just that the Yankees won?
It's over the top. That's what I didn't like. You know what? I grew up listening to Yankee games. I wins radio when they had to rotate through Messer and White and Rizzuto. Between two of them did TV, one of them did radio. Same thing with Mets, with Murphy and Kiner and Nelson. No, that's what – I'm a little bit older than you guys, so I do remember late 70s, early 80s with them.
I do too. More so. I honestly do.
And, you know, especially in the Yankees, you know, after they win, you know, they go to the post game for a couple of minutes and, you know, the Yankees score, New York wins, you know, that whole theme, if you remember that.
Remember, Rizzuto was always on the bridge by the seventh. Out of it after the sixth. Yep. He would get free doctor exams. He would call, find out if any doctors were in the stadium because he was cheap as hell, and he'd be on the bridge by the seventh inning. Sorry, Kev.
No, that's okay. I think what one that really turned me off probably early on was Gooden's no-hitter. So Gooden gets the last out, and he's got to do his – the pop-up is caught. The Yankees win. The Yankees win. Oh, and by the way, Gooden just pitched a no-hitter. You know, I mean, the little things like that are just like something needs to override your call. And to me, a guy pitching no hitter overrides your stupid call.
And, you know, I disagree, but okay.
I'm going to tell you the same thing because because the Met broadcasts here are considered really good, but I hate Gary Cohen for a very similar reason. Gary Cohen, and it's 10-2. I'm going to stop it, Gary. Shut your mouth. Somebody throw you back in a locker and shut your mouth. So I get what you're saying when I don't root for a team because he's just it's just annoying. Okay, when it's 3-2, I'm all over it. When it's 10-2, shut up. So I get your point.
Hey, Bob.
You know, Gino likes
the Yankees go 15-3.
What, Dan?
Gino likes the demonstrative call all the time, and I don't blame you, right? I mean, there was a big thing with New York radio where – they would play the calls from Sterling from the night before. I mean, all of them. Like every homer, every major thing, and then the end of the game, because it was that much of when the Yankees were doing really well in particular, but when it was that much of part of the fabric of, I don't know, 55 to 60% of the city that were Yankee fans. The 40 to 45% that are Met fans just because of longevity at the time, you know, hated it. It's just the way it worked. But, you know, that's why the logo behind your head right now that has Knicks on it is probably the only New York team that everybody kind of galvanizes behind.
Very true.
So my big three were Bernie Williams, Burn Baby Burn, or Bernie Goes Boom. Matsui, A Thriller from Godzilla. I always liked that one. And then Gleyber Torres. To me, this one always struck me funny, and he used to go, "It's Gleyber Day, and like a good Gleyber, Torres is there."
He came up with original calls, and that's what made it fun. I mean, you know, John Sterling was a big part of baseball during a Yankee heyday period, which we have not had in a long time.
Yep.
That's baseball, Susan. That's just what it is. I mean, that's who he is. That's what it was. Again, textbook. He would never be confused with, like, oh, listen to this guy if you want to know how to call a game. But, you know what? Rest in peace, John Sterling. Any other final points for you guys?
Nope.
All right. Yankees at this point before today are 24-11. They won 4 in a row, 8-2 in their last 10. Mets at 13-22. They've won 2 in a row. They're 4-6 in their last 10. Kev, want to talk about the Mets for a couple minutes?
3 out of 4. Woo! Against Anaheim and Colorado. Yay.
You got to beat the teams you can beat, pal.
And you know, these are teams that have basically the same records, very similar records to the Mets. You know, I'm not going to get into the stuff I've been getting to the last couple of weeks. I mean, nothing's really changed. I mean, I'll pick up some positives. Clay Holmes, pitching great.
Enjoy the first half of the season, my friend.
You know what? I'm going to hope that last September he had made every start in September and had an ERA of 3.
Okay. How was he in August? Open,
I had a rough August, but I think that was part of getting through a full season as a starter. We'll see. I mean, I'm grasping at straws here. Don't you know that? And Darren, I'll give you one of the pointers that you mentioned, you know, in our preview was Vientos and how big that his bat could be. And I tell you, with all the injuries, he's been entrenched there at first base, even though the glove is a little iffy at times. But he's been hitting. He's one of the few guys that's been starting to consistently hit.
He's a dangerous bat when he gets in one of those streaks, man. He really is.
Yeah. And to me, some of it's going to be with Lindor out and with Mauricio now out with a broken thumb.
That hurt because you wanted to see the kid play every day. That's what ballage. It's less about the fact that he got hurt, but more about the fact he was going to get a chance to play every day. And now he got hurt. It's like
he had probably 6 weeks consecutive to be the shortstop. Now you get Bichette back at short for most days. Maybe Beatty, knowing that he's going to be playing third base every day and not worrying about first base and right field and wherever else they put him, maybe that'll calm him down. Maybe his bat will get going. I don't know. We'll see. You know what? Between the injuries, I mean, the weather. I'll be honest, too. The weather has not been good for the Mets all year. I mean, every time it's nice in New York, the Mets are on the road. They were canceled or postponed tonight because they're in Colorado with 30-degree weather with rain and possibly 1 to 3 inches of snow.
Nothing you can do about it.
Nothing to do about that.
Bench is also starting to hit a little bit, Kev. Bench is starting to show what we thought he could be.
Yep. 191 may not sound like much, but since he was under 100 3 weeks ago, you know what? It's improvement.
123 like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. You know, but like I said, between the injuries, which you can't, you know, well, Polanco and Robert, I'm shocked that those guys went on the DL, you know. The Soto and Lindor injuries, you're surprised at because they play 150, 160 games a year. But between that, the weather that you can't predict, but the schedule makers, let's be honest, didn't do the Mets any favor either. No. I mean, you take a look. I mean, who comes up with the schedule? You open up three games at home in Pittsburgh.
They got to put him somewhere, Kev.
Yeah, but.
Kev, stop, please. Please stop with the stupid schedule.
It's true.
You gotta play these teams at some point. Everybody's got bad games. You're not the only one. You're not the only one. You're not the only one. You're not the only one, Kev.
And San Francisco, you come home for a week. Out to L.A.
Nobody's and no other teams are doing that, Kev. At 13-22, you shouldn't be worried about where you're playing games, Kev.
The one point I'll say, though, to defend
13-22, you shouldn't be worried about where you're playing games.
Is that your second half should be very favorable. So if you're able, you won't have any trips like this in the second half, really. Right? So
right. After we get through early June, we go at Seattle and San Diego because that's our fourth West Coast trip separately.
Well, that's the way it happens when you play the West Coast, though. You know that.
But you can't make it 2 trips out far west instead of 4?
Nobody else is doing that but you, Kev.
What?
It's a Met problem. It's not a baseball problem. I get it.
It's the National League East problem this year. When they have to play the AL West, it gets brutal. I get it. Yankees play the NL West.
But to me, at St. Louis, at San Fran, home for a week, at L.A., at Chicago, you couldn't combine San Fran and L.A. in one trip and not have to go out to the West Coast a second time in 3 weeks?
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I will say this, I will say this, Kev. They're traveling better on these flights than you and I would taking a bus across town. Very true. You know, it's not like these guys aren't getting some. I know they're switching time zones and stuff, but they're also making a lot of money. I know they didn't do many favors, but at the same point in time, it's not like the old days where they're taking trains to freaking Chicago and Cincinnati. This is like, they're taking chartered flights and they're getting treated like gold. But it is not a very friendly start for them.
And trust me, I'm not faulting the schedule for their bad record. They're playing badly. Don't get me wrong. But the schedule makers did them no favors either.
It's a baseball problem, though. This isn't a Met problem, though.
This is an interleague problem that has lost its luster and should be gone.
I agree.
I think if it was, or even if we spread it out over the full season, you don't compress it all in the first month and a half. You know, we could have done a better job with pen and paper rather than a computer.
No, you couldn't have. Trust me, by the way.
There's the one guy that did the NFL schedule we talked about a few weeks ago. That guy's my freaking hero. Anyway, yep. Because he did it with a pen and paper until they took it away from him.
All right, I'm done.
National League, Atlanta before today, 25-11, Cubs 23-12, Dodgers 22-13. Those are the three division leaders at the moment. Darren, Yankees.
Pirates swept the Reds, all five teams in the NL Central above 500. I mean, a lot of things happening. The Cardinals playing well. Let's get to the Yankees. Yankees are playing great, and yet they can't pull away from Tampa, who's equally playing great, by the way. But you can't take that away from the Yankees right now. Bellinger's starting to find his swing. I think Dominguez has been okay since he's come up. He's been involved in a few things. He's getting on. Judge is, becoming Judge all of a sudden again.
Judge and Rice are just on fire.
What was that?
Judge and Rice are on fire.
Absolutely. Rice is playing amazing. Chisholm had a big homer tonight. They spotted Texas 3 in the first. They're up 6-3 now in the seventh. Bellinger with a big two-run double. I mean, a lot of good things happening with the Yankees. The funny part is that Boston, Toronto, and Baltimore all suck and win. And Tampa, every year, somehow, some way, finds a way to stay competitive. And the Yankees only, a game and a half up on them? I think it's really right there. But, right now it's very hard to criticize. The pitching is coming around. Cole should be back soon. Rodon isn't that far behind from everything you hear. We won't have to see Rodriguez pitch anymore. Not that he was awful, but he wasn't great tonight. It's really the bullpen's going to be the only thing that really holds this team back. Even McMahon's over 200 now out of nowhere. Caballero's been great. Volpe got sent to AAA because they can't mess with it, G.
So, yeah, they're going to keep Volpe in the minors for a little bit longer. You think maybe they give him some time at third base? Knowing Caballero's playing well, knowing Lombard Jr.'s on the way at some point, maybe not this year, but next year.
I think so. I think that that's the place where he's going to be. He's going to have to be the utility guy right now. And if he can't do it, then Caballero becomes that guy if he falls off. But right now, you play the hot hand, and Caballero's getting on every game. He's in the middle of it right now.
He's getting on base, stealing bases.
No, absolutely,
14 steals.
Yeah,
him and Jazz were ridiculous right now.
Yeah. Jazz hit a monster shot to break the 3-3 tie tonight. I mean, again, the pitching's good, and the starting pitching has held up better than expected with the injuries to the point where, Schlittler leads the league in ERA. It's April, it's May 5th or 6th, whatever it is. So before I have a heart, go crazy and anoint him a saint, but Schlittler's been everything you could hope for. Again, there's a lot of things to like about where this team is at right now. We'll see what happens.
You would figure the bullpen will need help at some point. We're months away from, I think, from anybody coming in here at this point, unless it's a minor leaguer or one of these starters gets moved when Rodon or Cole comes back.
You figure Hill is probably the most likely guy to go to the pen. If he doesn't walk the world, he's got the electric arm that maybe can do something.
You're probably going to have to move somebody else also.
No doubt. I mean, I think it was the Oriole announcer that was doing Doval, pitching the other day. And his comment was, how does this guy have a 6.7 ERA? Because he was throwing BBs in that game. And it's like they have guys with good stuff. They just haven't translated.
Yeah.
Out of that pen. Even Bednar hasn't been perfect. He's been good, though. But listen, It's weird when you say it because, as Jet fans, Kevin and I always say, we expect to have great centers. There's nothing else we expect. But we expect our center to be really good, and it's not really great right now, and it pisses me off. For the Yankees, because of going Wetland to Rivera all those years, whenever the closer to Chapman, whenever the closer isn't like amazing, it stands out. Bednar's really good, but he's not at that level where Matt Moe was for so long that you just got used to just counting the ninth inning as over. And now you have to watch the ninth inning. And it's like a little bit more annoying. But, you know, Yankees are playing great. And, you know, you're excited to watch it.
Any other baseball points? I mean, Scooble goes down. That's a big one for me.
Absolutely.
That was big news. You know,
he's got one other for you guys.
He's got what they call it? Loose
bodies in the elbow.
Loose bodies in the elbow.
This Dino's going to hate, but I'm going to throw it out there.
Probably 3 months is the known, you know, time frame. Not specifically for him, but just in general, whenever they come up with this loose bodies in the elbow phrase. So, Darren?
And the thing about it is that's why you take the contract when you can get the contract. When you're a pitcher, you can't sit there and hold on because the injuries come so easy now.
Yeah.
Former, you know, Oriole and Met, Mike Bordick. Okay.
Bordick.
His comment, when retired MLB players who love this game and now can barely stand to watch what it has become, there's a problem. The ignorant people will suggest it's because we won't evolve. But the reality is that the game has developed into a glorified showcase where every hit and every pitch has to be measured by some tech device to somehow give it more value. A hit is still a hit no matter what the exit velocity is. You don't get extra credit for hitting it harder, as of yet, anyway. Mike Bordick. Thoughts, boys?
I generally agree. I like having all of the stats at my fingertips. If I was in the front office, I want all those stats as a supplement to what I'm seeing on the field. You know, I still think we've gone away from the scouts and I think gone away from seeing what's on the back of the baseball card and gone too much with all this other stuff. And it gets to be too much.
Well, I mean, we all saw Moneyball. We all thought it was a good movie, the whole thing. But you see that scene where Brad Pitt's in front of all the scouts saying, you know, you guys don't know if they're any good any more than anybody else does. And we're going to the computers, and that's why whatever the Jordan Hill's what's his name, not Jonah Hill's character's name was Pete. You know, whatever Pete was, and he kept pointing to him because he gets on base, because he does this, because it became a stat game, and it started to, you know, turn it. Bill James started to turn it. And then the Red Sox win the World Series in 2004, and it had become solidified. And I'm not saying that the advanced stats are bad, because they're not. It's good to have it, but the feel from the managers is something that we lack now a little bit more. Now, some might say that was always overrated. Maybe the field didn't really matter at all. Maybe it was, you know, maybe Zimmer and Torrey just got lucky. Maybe there was no feel at all when the two of them were in the dugout. Who knows? But, you know, it just feels like it's a little bit more the GM is the manager and the manager is the babysitter. So, I don't know. Just, G, any thoughts on Bordick?
No. I think it is what it is. Has it gone too far? Yeah, probably. If 30 GMs are going to continue to do it this way, well, then 30 teams are going to continue to do it that way.
I got it, G. Kev, I'm sorry. You were about to say something?
I was going to say, you know, the other day with the Mets, you know, MJ Melendez. Mm-hmm. Off to a terrific start, you know, he's hot. Home run, another base hit, playing well. You pick up Austin Slater. He had one at bat in about 10 days. They're going to pinch it from him in a key spot because there's a lefty on the mound. I'm not putting Melendez on a stool, but don't your eyes tell you, hey, Melendez has some good at bats here. Let's give him a shot.
Well, that's the thing. We were just talking about Caballero and the reason why Volpe has to go down.
Yeah.
Or learn another position because you play the hot hand.
You play the hot
Sometimes
hand.
Sometimes the hot hand doesn't happen as much as it used to.
Yeah.
It used to be where a guy sat in that lineup and he took jobs away from time to time. You know, Lou Gehrig, you know, before our time, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, so I just thought it was interesting that a former baseball player pointed that out. Mike Bordick, you know, was we all knew him. You know, he wasn't an all-star by any stretch, but he was a solid baseball player. Ken, you have some gems to talk about, right?
Yeah. A couple of interesting things in the majors. Last Thursday, Philly at home against San Fran, doubleheader. They walked it off in game 1-3-2. They walked it off in game 2, 6-5, and 10 innings. First time two walk-off hits in the same day since the Pirates in 2004 against the Cubbies. So something that hasn't happened in 23 years. Chase Sugart was the winning pitcher in both games. First time in the same day that the guys had two wins. It's the great Brian Dentzing in 2013. You remember him, right?
I do remember him. I mean, I can't pick him out of a lineup, but I remember the name and box scores. How about that?
Two walk-offs with the same winning pitcher in the same day. You had to go all the way back to 1983, Jesse Orosco against the Pirates.
Ah, the fiasco.
Jesse Orosco.
Game one, Justin Crawford had the game-winning hit. Go back to 2014, 12 years ago. Carl Crawford with a walk-off hit for the Dodgers. Manager in both games to the team, Matt Ainley.
It's great. That's a great stat.
You know, the last couple of weeks I've been given, you know, these weird games and these weird scoring innings and this and that. Well, it's now bled over into the major leagues. The other day, the Steelers beat the Bengals 17-7. I'm sorry, the Pirates beat the Reds 17-7. Pittsburgh 5 in the first. They come up in the second. Rhett Lauder's on the mound for the Reds. Cruz strikes out leading off. Lowe walks. Reynolds walks. O'Hearn walks. Go to the bullpen, bring in Connor Phillips. Gonzalez walks. Ozuna walks. Horowitz walks. Griffin walks. Yes, that's seven consecutive walks to tie a record. Four runs in at that point. In comes Sam Moll. He gives up a fielder's choice. And then Cruz makes his second out of the inning with a ground up to the catcher of all things. Five runs, no hit, second inning.
Unbelievable.
And just one of those strange things, Dustin May this year switched to number 3 as his new uniform number for the Red Sox. Of course, as the way the schedule worked out, he was on the mound May 3rd with his back of the uniform saying May 3rd.
May 3rd, nice.
That's
and those are my little hidden gems.
Awesome stuff, man. Awesome stuff.
We're moving over to the NBA. I think the Knicks are playing well, Kev.
Let's go back to last Thursday.
Okay. Six,
Atlanta led 11-9. The next 18 minutes was maybe the greatest stretch of basketball in NBA history. I'm not exaggerating here. They outscored Atlanta 67-14 in 18 minutes.
Wow.
They closed the first quarter 31-4. They opened the second quarter 20-4, took a 40-point lead with 7:12 left. Fastest anybody's ever gotten the 40-point lead.
Oh, my God.
The 12-3 run got up to 50. That's when we were starting to exchange texts and all because we couldn't believe it. 72-22 with 4:39 left. That was the fastest anybody's ever gotten up by 50. Oh, by the way, that would have been the fastest anybody would have got up by 40 also. That's how badly they blew out the Hawks.
The Falcons, yeah. Hawks.
And the amazing thing is that, you know, thanks to the route, they were able to get the entire bench. All 15 players played. All 15 players scored. So they moved on to the round two very easily. As it turned out, they're playing Philly because Philly takes game 6 at home against Boston. Embiid and Maxey lead the way there. And then game 7 in Boston, you know, Boston just had no answers. Maxey 30-11-7, Embiid 34-12-6. And Philly holds line to win by 9 and advance to play the Knicks. Any thoughts on that series?
Well, I mean, I want to give you a little recap of game one and try to find the turning point. I think it was the opening tip.
Yeah.
The Knicks are on a roll right now that we haven't seen because this has not been an offensive team through our history of being Knicks fans, okay? Last time this was an offensive team was the Bernard King days, and everything was a two. You know, it was a turnaround jumper from the baseline. Yeah. Bill Cartwright inside. you know, Rory Sparrow, you know, dishing and driving and shooting. It's a different thing. I mean, now everybody can hit. And when you get Bridges and Ananobi hitting every shot they're taking, or most shots that they're taking, this team is almost unstoppable. Because Brunson, again, great call last night by Grant Hill. Or I think it was Hummel that actually said it. He's not fast, but he's so quick, it's ridiculous. Because that's the only way to describe him. He's not fast, and he can easily be victimized defensively. But the fact is that, you know, they come out the last three games, they win by 29 with what was the game three? 41, 51? What was it? I don't remember. The game six, what was it? What was the final?
51?
40-89?
51.
51. And then they won by 39 last night. I mean, it's like, you know, 119 points in three games.
Yeah,
they look unstoppable when everybody else is contributing. And you sit there and you watch Kolek come in. You're like, how come this kid doesn't get more minutes? He seems like he's dishing and swishing and doing everything Clyde would be saying right now, if we were able to listen to him do the calls. But right now, I don't remember a Nick offensive juggernaut like we're seeing now. You know, this is something that's amazing to watch, guys.
Yeah, the offense is playing great, and I think in this series, especially the defense, you know, Bridges can D up Maxey to some degree. And if he's got chip in also, he also has 17 in game one on 7 of 10. So if he can chip in anything offensively, alone helping to shut down Maxey, and then to counter Embiid, you know, Cat's got to start the game on him, but you've got Mitchell Robinson. You've got Ariel
Hakori.
Say that name. You know, you've got 3 7-footers to go against Embiid.
And if he's definitely still not healthy. He got a little running through the screen last night, and he got hurt. But he came back very early from the abdominal injury he had.
And if you want to change it up, you've got a little smaller. I don't have a problem with OG getting on for a couple of minutes just to change things up too. I mean, they've got multiple guys that can run at Embiid, which the Celtics didn't have down in the last couple of games and in the last round. So I think the Knicks can very easily take care of this in five.
When OG is playing this well on both sides of the ball, the Knicks are a different team. I'm sorry. They just are. You get Brunson and Towns playing, and OG starts playing this well, they're going to be tough to beat in this conference, I will tell you right now. Now, one thing, did you see the minutes when Mitch Robinson came in? That they were basically doing hack shack on him.
Yeah.
That could become an issue if Towns gets into some foul trouble early and they have to do this for any extended period of time, this could become an issue because Robinson is horrible. And I like him, but he is just atrocious at the free throw line. But listen, you know, when OG's playing like this, they're just a different team. I mean, they're on a different level right now. How many games do you think Philly's going to win, guys?
One.
I said two, but now I'm going to go back to one as well because I originally thought six when we posted it on social. But I'm going to – I mean, you know, I think right now they're just a better team. The difference maker for Philly, you know, Edgecombe, if he has a big, you know, he could be the guy. You know, they have a couple of shooters there, but with Embiid not at 100%, it doesn't seem like they have much of a shot. Maxey's a great player, but he's going up against length and he's going up against a lot of bodies.
And the fact that they don't really have a bench, it really comes into play when you have to sit some of these guys down for some minutes.
And you see, you know, Paul George toward the end of his career now can't give you the minutes he used to and a bunch of things like that. So, you know, we're going to see. But the Knicks, I mean, if they play like this, they can beat anybody in the NBA. They can beat OKC if they play like this.
Yeah.
It just, you know, that's a long, long time away. You know, Goldschmidt goes yard. Well, somebody dusted him off. There we go.
Kev, where else are we in the East, Kev?
Yep, we've got Detroit and Cleveland matching up. Detroit comes back from 3-1 against Orlando to take that series. Game six, Orlando at home is up 62-38 early third. They go out and miss 23 straight shots, and Detroit comes back and wins by 14 and win game seven easily. Cunningham 32 in each of those two games. Mm-hmm. And the Cleveland-Toronto matchup, Cleveland wins home court series. Every game was won by the home team. Game six was probably the best game of the series, the overtime game that R.J. Barrett with 1.2 left, if you didn't see the shot, shoots it from straight line, hits the back iron, straight up, straight back down through the hoop for the game winner. That was a good shot by R.J. Barrett, but then Cleveland comes out and wins by 12 fairly easily game seven.
Jared Allen was the difference in that game. He became a mismatch that Toronto had no answer for.
Yep.
That shot was reminiscent of the Knick loss last year.
Yeah, very much so. So game one tonight, Detroit. And I think Detroit learned some lessons, facing elimination and coming back from 24 down, I think helps them to some degree, helps them grow up a little bit. And they took care of Cleveland in game one by 10. This series should go long, though. I wouldn't be surprised if this goes 6 or 7.
I agree.
I would think so.
Out west, when we talked last week, OKC and Spurs have already clinched. The Timberwolves took out the Nuggets in game six. Jaden McDaniels with the big game there, 32-10.
That's without Ant, man. I mean, it's crazy, right?
That sets them up for game one against the Spurs, and Ant Edwards was back for game one.
Yep.
And he came off the bench, 18 points in 25 minutes off the bench. The T-Wolves get the 104-102 win in San Antonio, so they steal home court. Wemby, the historic triple-double, 11 points, 15 rebounds, 12 blocks.
12 blocks, man. Woo!
Now, Minnesota's complaining that about 4 or 5 of them are probably goaltending.
When you're 7'6", everything's coming down.
Yeah. But only two other players.
When a wingspan of like 8'8", I mean, everything's coming down.
Only two other players with blocks included with a triple-double effort. When you say, Hakeem.
Okay.
The other one I can give you 100 guesses you want to come up with it.
Okay.
Not Chris Dudley, is it?
Andrew Bynum.
Oh, wow. Andrew Bynum.
But here's the problem with Wemby's triple-double, 11 points. 5 for 17, including 0 for 8 from 3.
Yeah, it's horrible.
You're 7'6". If you can't hit your first couple, get your head under the basket.
They can't guard you down low. Nobody can. You're 7'6".
And the other series, the Rockets and the Lakers. Lakers took care of that in 6 games. LeBron with a big 6 game there, 28-7-8. So they open up with the OKC tonight, a little bit later.
OKC's up by about 9 right now.
Oh, okay.
Last I saw.
Yeah. OKC's up 11 at this moment with 2 minutes left, 2.5 minutes left in the second.
Okay.
Houston could not overcome Durant not being there, and that it just wasn't enough. They just showed they just didn't have enough weapons if they don't have Durant hitting shots for him. I know, listen, L.A. was banged up too. It wasn't like it was just one-sided in that, but L.A. had enough guys that could put the ball in the hole. Houston simply did not.
Any other NBA points?
No, I mean, I got a couple of points, though, I want to give you guys, with a couple of treasures from the NBA and a few others.
Sure.
Okay. That's right with you guys. A couple of real quick things. Number one, Cooper Flagg, okay? First player in the history of basketball to win National High School Player of the Year, NCAA Player of the Year, and NBA Rookie of the Year. He won the high school award. He should have been a junior. He won the NCAA award. He should have been a senior. And he won the NBA award. He should have been a freshman in college.
Wow.
I think there's an upside with this.
Yeah.
Last week, Dante DiVincenzo, a week and a half ago, tore his Achilles. 4 players in the last 2 seasons in the playoffs have torn their Achilles. DiVincenzo, Halliburton, Tatum, and Lillard. All 4 wear number 0.
Wow.
I'm just saying. I thought that was an odd one. Baseball, real quick. Troy Gloss in 2000 led the AL in home runs with 47. He had a 7.8 WAR and a 1008 OPS and received 0 MVP votes. Nowhere along the line did he get an MVP vote.
Who won the MVP that year?
The MVP that year was why am I blanking? I had it in my head. Hold on one second. I'll tell you in a second because I have it. I have it right here. But it was like I'm going to give you the top 20. Actually, I don't have to go that deep, but you know what I mean. It's like one of the most amazing things you've ever seen, where you know one guy, Giambi won it. He had 14 first place votes. Frank Thomas was second. A-Rod was third. Delgado was four. Pedro five. Edgar six. Manny seven. Erstad eight. Omar nine. Jeter 10. Mike Sweeney 11. Maglio 12. David Justice 13. Bernie Williams 14. Tim Hubson 15. Miguel Tejada 16. Travis Fryman 17. David Wells 18. And Johnny Damon 19. Those are the only guys that had votes. The stats were ridiculous. Offense was ridiculous. But Troy Gloss got zero. He didn't even get a fifth place vote. And he led the league and all that. So I thought it was pretty interesting. This one I might have given you guys before, but it popped up again just in case I didn't. Gorman Thomas in a spring training game hit a stand-up double. Pulled out his lighter, set a fart on fire, and he cost Alfredo Griffin his eyebrow. I didn't know what else to say. That just seemed like it. On a sad note, a heart-wrenching note, USC wide receiver Brendan Rice received the call that he was being drafted last week at his best friend's funeral. He had just given the eulogy speech. One of the most bittersweet moments ever, but he did get to share one last special moment with his best friend.
Wow.
Really kind of crazy. Baseball one. Okay, this is kind of an interesting one, right? The first ever out-of-the-park home run was 150 years ago, okay? Ross Barnes for the Chicago White Stockings, which is the Cubs, by the way, is credited with the first clean home run in National League history, an actual over-the-fence bomb, not an inside-the-park shot. There were ballparks in the era which had ground rules that said balls hit over short outfield walls were ruled doubles. You know, there's a lot of little things like that. Avenue Grounds in Cincinnati where Barnes hit his shot was not one of those parks. Barnes, in his career, also played for the Red Stockings and the Reds, and he hit six total home runs. He was also so dominant at slicing ground balls to go foul, which was considered in play at the time. So as long as it landed in, he knew how to slice it. He would get him into fair territory. That the league changed the rules to closer resemble the fair foul rules we see today.
Wow.
I believe that is all I have for that.
Okay. NHL. Head over to NHL.
Yep.
Kev, want to start?
We'll start with the Eastern Conference, the Atlantic Division. Game six last week, Boston lost to Buffalo at home 4-1. Pretty easy victory for Buffalo to close out that series. Tampa, Montreal, it may be the most competitive. Well, definitely the most competitive.
Oh, it was a great series.
Montreal wins games 1-3, 5-7. Tampa Bay wins games 2-4, 6. All of them are one goal games. Game six, I mean, terrific. 1-0 overtime by Tampa. Goncalves, 9:03 of overtime to win that one. And then in game seven, 1-1 in the third, and Newhook, 11:07 of the third to give Montreal the 2-1 lead and the win.
Montreal had as many shots on goal in the second period as the three of us did. They had nine shots on goal for the freaking game, none in the second period, and still won. Great game. I mean, the intensity of playoff hockey when the games are close, there's nothing like it. I'm sorry. No sport really equals it in that respect.
Nope. So Sabres-Canadiens, game one tomorrow night.
Yep.
In the Metropolitan, Carolina had advanced. They were waiting to see what happened. In Philadelphia, another 1-0 overtime win. York at 17:32 of the overtime. Vladar with 42 saves for Philly. I mean, Shelovs, 31 out of 32 stops, but not good enough. And Philly goes on to play Carolina. And they've already played two games. I mean, they got their first series over, so let's get going. Why waste time?
Game one before game seven.
That's ridiculous, by the way. That's absolutely friggin' ridiculous. The NHL should be shot.
Nah, they're done.
First off, can the NHL bracket this goddamn thing 1-8 like every other damn league? Instead of threes playing twos and ones and fours, and you never know who the hell's playing who. Can they just reseed everything 1-8 to start the damn playoffs? And then even – listen, even the NBA isn't this stupid to have a team play two games to start when another team hasn't played a game yet. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Why not?
Because at some point
– week and a half.
Because at some point, that's the way it works. It's not – oh, yeah, let's just keep playing.
The series – And the other series goes seven. I mean, Caroline's going to be sitting there for a while, and you're going to have the rust versus you know, the team that's playing. I mean, it's going to be interesting if that's
well, they've already played two games. For
Carolina, they're the best team though. And they're 6-0. I mean,
yeah.
You know, Philly jumped on them 2-0 last night. Carolina grinded back, took them in overtime, late overtime.
If
Lamar, who I watch play so much, it looks great, but you know, Carolina's just. Gifted. Philly actually dominated the overtime. Just
if fucking the net. If Carolina sweeps the Flyers, their last game will be May 9th. At that point, the Sabres will have played Montreal twice, May 6th to May 8th.
Yep.
So they're going to wait at some point. It's not like they're not going to wait.
Unless the series goes seven.
Well, no, but
it doesn't sweep. They'll catch up eventually.
Absolutely ridiculous. NHL should be shot.
Out west, the Central. Colorado had advanced already. Minnesota wins game six against Dallas, 5-2, with a couple of late 19-ers as well. So that kicks off Colorado and Minnesota already started.
Game two now.
They played the most fun game probably of the entire playoffs. Colorado wins the defensive thriller 9-6.
Listen, and you know what? It wasn't like it was bad goaltending. I mean, it's just amazing offense in this. I mean, they scored three in the first 5 minutes tonight. They've only been one goal since, and we're late in the second. I mean, or end of the second now. But, I mean, this is like Colorado is like a machine.
Oh, they're so good.
And Minnesota isn't that far behind because Quinn Hughes brings them something that not every team has. He has that defenseman that almost is on that level of Makar where he can make so many things happen. And, you know, just him, you know, leading the power play, Minnesota already pulled the goalie, changed goalies for game two. He's only given up three goals tonight, so we'll see how that goes. They go back to Gustafson, but it's like it's nuts, man. It's just nuts.
And then in the Pacific Division, Vegas unfortunately knocked out Utah. Game five was a terrific game. Double overtime. Brett Howden, the shorthanded goal in double overtime, 5:38 in. And then Vegas took care of Utah easily, 5-1 in game six. Anaheim, in the meantime, took care of Edmonton, also in game six. And that set up Vegas and Anaheim. And game one, Vegas wins 3-1. Bobrishev, 15:02 of the third period, plus a Marner empty netter. So they lead 1-0.
Yeah, I mean, and Anaheim looks good. I mean, they're skating real well. I didn't think they had a shot of beating Edmonton. Edmonton made two straight finals. I hate Edmonton. I was so excited. But, I mean, the simple fact is I can't stay up for the games. I just have to get the box scores the next day. I watch like a period. I'm like, all right, I'm going to bed. But it's, you know, we got good hockey right now. Let's see if it stays like this. They had the, what's it called, tonight, the draft order tonight. Maple Leafs get the first pick. Rangers get 5, Devils 12, Islanders 13, Flames get the 6th pick. For those in New York that really care besides me. Carolina, Philly, Buffalo, Montreal is a series I think that's going to be great.
Yeah.
And I think this Colorado, Minnesota series is going to end up being a little better than people think as well.
All right. Let's move over to horse racing. Oh, wait, Kev, go ahead. You got something else? I'm sorry. Okay. This past Saturday, we had the 152nd run for the Roses. Long shot, Golden Tempo, ridden by Jose Ortiz. Made a stretch run for the ages, coming from dead last to win. Sherry DeVoe became the first female trainer ever to win the Kentucky Derby. Second female to win a Triple Crown race.
Mm-hmm.
Golden Tempo was a 23-1 shot, takes home the $3.1 million purse. Bets, $2 bet. The win bet paid $48.24. Renegade, $7. And the show Ocelli, that was, he ran out of the 22 spot, paid $36. The Exacta, $2 Exacta Kev, paid $278.86.
With the
and I actually said this on our text chain, the trifecta was going to pay out big. A 50-cent trifecta paid $5,625.39. And Darren, if you added Chief Wallaby to the superfecta, a $1 superfecta paid out a calm and cool collective $94,489.95. Listen, Golden Tempo came from way back to win this. I thought there was a lot of bumping and the horses were bumping around a little bit. It's hard. I think it's hard not to when the field is that big. Wound up only being 19 horses as they went off. Darren?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, like you said, these horses will never race 18 competitors in a race again. I mean, this is it. This is the race where this happens because, that you know, it's because of the point system. So the last week we mentioned, you know, Golden Tempo, deep closer, you know, deep closer. That's all we knew. He was 25 lengths back. What do I deep? He was dead last. He dead was like, deep. Four lengths back to Golden Tempo. You know, I mean, that was the call around the track. Caught the favorite Renegade just before the finish line to win it. Little excitement before the race, before we get into the race. We had a Great White scratched after he threw his jockey and flipped over backwards. So Alex Achard was knocked off, and we had a little bit of a delay in the start. For Jose Ortiz, the rider of Golden Tempo, it's his first win in 11 Derby tries. He passed Renegade, whose brother Erod was on, who has now 0 for 10 in the Derby. Ocelli, whatever, 70 to 1. Still hasn't won a race, but he made for a big, you know, still a maiden, but made for a huge, you know, triple. Chief Wallaby, you know, passed the tired horse for fourth. A lot of horses were in there for a shot. I mean, you saw a lot of different numbers popping up at different moments. And when you got to the stretch and you saw Renegade start to make the move, it was really hard to think that Renegade wasn't going to take it. Renegade got a great trip from Ortiz. Everything seemed to work right for the horse. I mean, he got him out of trouble, got wide. And when you watch the replay, because Golden Tempo is not really in your screen until very late, so you have to watch it again. And Gino was talking before we did the broadcast how he DVRs it and rewatches the race. When you see Golden Tempo, the way he maneuvers around and just blows by horses that are getting tired, you're still saying, well, he's too far back. That finish line's coming. Nope, it's getting closer. Nope, it's getting closer. And he gets to even terms with his brother. And beats him, and you know what? We get yet another thrilling Derby race. The call's amazing. The race is amazing. You can say what you want. It is always going to be the most exciting 2 minutes in sports until a front runner goes wire to wire where nobody even touches him. But we haven't seen that in a while. We're seeing a lot of big closures at the end of these races, at least horses that are coming from at least 14th, 15th position to take it lately. And great race, Kev, right? I mean, not much more to say, just a well-ridden race by Jose Ortiz.
Yeah, we wheeled it in. I was at my 40th high school reunion Saturday. And, of course, Class of 86 Holy Cross, and Mike Rapoli was from Class of 86 Holy Cross. So they had a wheel in the TV so we could watch it. And, you know, somebody brought up the point, all the numbers line up for him. It had been 40 years since a horse won from the one post, 1986. First he graduated in 86. Mike's Nona, Saturday was her sixth anniversary of her passing. I mean, everything just seemed to be lining up for Mike. And then when Renegade made that move, I thought for sure he had it. And then Golden Tempo, just like you said, the run of runs and tremendous job by Jose Ortiz to beat out his brother. And I mean, let's face it, that's why you watch horse racing, for that type of finish.
And the call is just – the call is incredible. I mean, we did for last week's show, we played the Giacomo call, which was somewhat similar because he came from the clouds. Yep. It was actually as apropos as any call we could have picked last week, because this was the same type of finish for Golden Tempo. You didn't know he was in it, and then all of a sudden, is that goal? Is that 19 or 15 for a second? I'm trying to see because I'm Devin. My daughter's on top of me. We're watching the race. She has no idea what's going on. She's just yelling in my ear, so I can't hear anything. And it was just one of those things. So, great race. I mean, you know, congratulations. You know, first female trainer ever. Really amazing moment, man. Great job. Really great job.
Yeah.
Any other final points on the horse racing, boys?
We'll find out who's running in 2 weeks for the Preakness.
And we'll be letting you know who's running in 2 weeks. Next week, we'll be able to let you know who's definitely in.
It won't be 20 horses. You know, Darren will have only have to go through about half that number.
I'm going
to
go through 8 or 9, and it'll be a lot of horses that, you know, a lot will come from the Derby and a lot won't. And, you know, it'll be one of those situations for people that really have set it up for the shortest of the three races. And that's what the Preakness becomes.
What's funny is that, you know, next week is a week and a half. It's the Preakness at Laurel, not at Pimlico.
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
And we finish up with the Belmont at Saratoga, not at Belmont.
This will be the last year, though, of that.
Yep.
Next year we go back to Belmont, which will get us back to that mile and a half that we're accustomed to. And, you know, that race isn't always about the closers as much as the Derby is. And it used to be the other way around. It's really kind of like switched up a little bit. But fantastic, fantastic race.
Yep.
All right. Darren, got
two quick things. Number one, I'm going to start with college football. Just because there's one controversy going on right now. Just transferred to Texas Tech quarterback Brendan Sorsby is in the middle of a controversy right now. He left Cincinnati, went to Texas Tech, but he's on the NCAA investigation for making bets via a gambling app. So now we got to find out what they find out. Will he be in the supplemental draft? Because he's a guy that's kind of projected as a potential first-round pick next year. You also have to see how this is going to be affected because we all have gambling apps on our phones now, especially on the states where it's legal. It's not impossible to imagine a lot of college athletes getting caught up in stuff like this. It's just too easy to do. So we're going to have to figure out what happens with Sorsby. College basketball, a couple of other things, and they both involve Duke. The number one player in the 2028 class is a kid named A.J. Williams. He just signed a 2-year, $4.8 NIL deal with Duke. The deal will compensate the 16-year-old during his junior and senior years of high school before even enrolling in college. You know, it's like, where are we now? What's going on? I mean, this kid, I mean, he's not signed by Duke yet to play, but he's getting paid as a junior and a senior in high school to be the guy that is most likely going to say yes to Duke. But there's no lock in that. This just gives him a little bit of an edge. But also with Duke, Duke just signed a multi-year deal with Amazon to broadcast several of their games each year. This could change everything with cable and networks and the conference contracts. This is going to get crazy, guys. Yep. This is Notre Dame, but there are more than one Duke. And Notre Dame's Notre Dame, and I know the Big Ten and the SEC are big, but they have huge contracts. But for basketball, not so much. Duke, they haven't won a championship in a while, Duke. There's going to be other schools, clamoring for these opportunities. This is just the start of something that's going to get out of control. One last point. We all remember, you know, Sister Jean with Loyola, and we remember Larranaga's George Mason team and Dusty May leading Florida Atlantic to the Final Four and Dunk City with Florida Gulf Coast upsetting Georgetown. Mouse McFadden, Cleveland State, right? Harold the Show, Arsenault Weber. Remember that guy? Fettes Dembo at Wyoming. But before all those guys was a player named Al Frederick the Great. Al Frederick Hughes in 1985 averaged 26 points a game, led Loyola Chicago Ramblers to the Sweet 16, where they fell to eventual runner-up Georgetown because Georgetown got upset by Nova that year. Al Frederick the Great died this week. He was born in 62, so he was, I don't know, maybe 63 or 64 years old, depending on where his birthday fell. But he was one of those first guys. He averaged 26 points a game that year. They upset a really good SMU team that had Konkak, who was a lottery pick. Yep. They also beat Iona in the first round, which was a different time, but Iona was pretty good back then too. So one of those great first names that I remember, Al Frederick Hughes, Al Frederick the Great, passes away, I think at 63 years old, but I'm not 100% sure. And that's what I have for college hoops. You guys have anything else?
No, I think we can wrap it up.
Kev, you good?
I'm good.
We are the Sports Kings from Queens. Darren here with Kevin, here with Gino, talking about the wonderful, wild, and wacky world of sports. A wacky world where we salute John Sterling. Well, two-thirds of us salute John Sterling. And we also can mention names like Al Frederick the Great, Fennis Denbo, and Mouse McFadden. Please download the podcast anywhere you get a podcast, whether it be a Apple product, Spotify, TuneIn, whatever you like. We also are posting a lot on social. Didn't post after the last two Knick games because there was nothing to talk about. They blow everybody out, but we'll get more up there. So please download our stuff. If you don't like it, pretend you do. Share it with everybody you know. And without any further ado, may your sports be with you.